Welcome to episode 44 for July 31st, 2007. We're going to kick things off with a director spotlight on my favorite director of all time, Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm sure one segment isn't going to be enough to do it, so this is the start of something big. Following that, the trivia question as usual, then a Film Buff's Dictionary, where Steven's going to talk about undercranking and overcranking and all that stuff. Top six is going to be on great remakes. And wrapping things up, Steven's got a movie idea for me, and he's going to pitch it to me, and we'll see if I give him the money to make the movie. I'm Sam Stoddard.
I'm Steven Keller. And, you know, Sam, I think we should push out the Coen Brothers segment. We should bring in a remake of the industry trend Blacklist segment. I just feel like it wasn't strong enough. I think, you know, this time we need Dalton Trumbo, helicopters, and nuclear explosions. All right, so what do you think about that? I redid my intro for episode 42. I think it's even better than the first time. Does that work? An improvement?
We're back for another director's spotlight, and it's Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, where do we even start with this one? Hitchcock is one of the most famous, celebrated directors of all time, even by people who don't know the name of any other director. Maybe they know Spielberg and Hitchcock, and those are the two they know. His appeal is so broad because critics and film historians consider him one of the greatest directors of all time, but he made populist kinds of movies. He was a crowd pleaser. And so it's kind of unusual for those two groups of people to intersect on a critical opinion like that. Like Spielberg, speaking of him, one of his greatest gifts was this uncanny sense of what people wanted to see. He knew what people wanted, and he was able to deliver that. He's nicknamed the Master of Suspense because, you know, most of his movies are thrillers of one sort or another, and he was really good at putting you on edge. And also extremely influential in establishing the genre in the first place and refining it. And he understood what made people feel suspense, and he exploited that. You know, he knew how to pace movies, an uncanny sense of pacing and timing and how to keep things taut. But also, as essential as things like timing is to ratchet up the suspense in a good thriller, you also need psychological realism. I mean, it's something you're not necessarily thinking about as you watch his movies. Hopefully you're not, in fact. But you need to have a story about characters that feel authentic to you. You don't want, as a lot of lame thrillers have, these characters that are sort of in service to the plot. They go do this thing because that's what makes the story work. You don't have that in a Hitchcock movie in general. You have characters who are driven by their own obsessions, and the way they interact is what the story unfolds out of. It's not the other way around. So Hitchcock understood this as well, and that's why we care about what happens to the characters, and that's why when he does the suspense thing, you know, we're invested in the outcome. His characters tend to be pretty flawed. They have temptations and obsessions and things that lead them down dark paths and get them into trouble, and they're things that we tend to understand. Just in general, Stephen, what appeals to you about Hitchcock's movies?
Well, you know, what I really love about Hitchcock is he does what really, really great popular artists do, and that is he makes movies that are just really, really fun, entertaining, and yet, when you go back and look at them and you watch them multiple times, you realize how much more is going on. He does, it's sort of like that Shakespeare thing where you have both high and low art at the same sort of time where, you know, you have these really accessible, wonderful thrillers, but the more you look at them, the more you realize, yeah, okay, there's a lot of depth here. Hitchcock's really, really saying something, but he's not hitting us over the head with his messages. He's letting it be more subtle, and he's wrapping it all in just these wonderfully paced and wonderfully told stories.
Exactly. In fact, I was going to make that point a little later on, so thanks for doing it for me. Yeah, it's there. And Hitchcock was the first director that I came to love as a director, and he was kind of, his movies kind of led me into this world of the movies, of studying them and everything. And yeah, at first I enjoyed them as thrillers. I loved them because they were suspenseful. They are. And then later on, once you start thinking about it a bit more, there's more to them once they're over. You know, you can still rewatch them and rewatch them and think about them and get more out of them. And as I've grown, I've perceived more in those movies. Very prolific guy, too. I mean, his career spans something like 50 years from the 20s to the 70s. So, I mean, think about that. He started out in silent film and then made the transition to sound and then the transition to color and then to widescreen and then beyond the fall of the Hays Code. And for each of these transitions, he was able to adapt pretty much instantly to the new technology or the new way of making movies and right off the bat just start making innovative uses of it. We talked before about the movie Blackmail, which was more or less Britain's first sound film, and straight away, you know, we get some very creative, effective uses of sound. So not only is he making use of the technology, he's making creative use of the technology and progressive use. Clearly, I mean, his mind was just very much oriented toward film. Some people say that he used storyboards extensively to plan his movies because he didn't see the sense of experimenting when you're already on the set and rolling the film. He wanted to have the movie edited in his head before he even started shooting. And at that point, that's when you start making compromises because, oh, well, it's too expensive to do this or we can't get the arrangements to do this, so I have to adjust my vision. But he had the movie made in his head and on storyboards ahead of time. And people have discovered since that maybe he didn't storyboard as much as people thought he did, so more of it was in his head than they realized. So he just had a mind that was very much in tune with the way movies work. And he also was in tune with, as I say, the effect of film on his audiences. He knew how to time something. He knew how to build and release tension, summed up by the quote he had where he said, "There is no terror in the bang, only in the anticipation of it." And there was an example he used often to illustrate this point. Imagine a room full of guys, and they have this conversation with each other, and then suddenly a bomb under the table explodes. Well, that's a startling thing, and you're startled, and when it's over, in the next scene, you're on to something else. But now imagine that the audience knows ahead of time that there's a ticking bomb under the table. And so now the whole dynamics of this scene we're imagining is changed. Now you're watching this conversation unfold between these unwitting characters, and you're thinking about that bomb underneath the table and wondering if they're going to find it in time or if they're going to get away before it explodes or anything. You lose the surprise of the explosion, but in return, you've just made this long conversation come alive with suspense. And this is something Hitchcock understood very well. He didn't trade suspense for a quick shock, especially in the movie Vertigo, which is a brilliant example. I mean, I won't give the twist away in case you haven't seen it, but the idea was that there was going to be this twist at the end of the movie, a big kind of sixth sense moment, we might say, today. And the studio thought it was great, and Hitchcock had this bright idea, well, hey, let's move the twist from the end to the middle of the movie. And everybody's like, you don't put the twist in the middle of the movie, then why do you keep watching the rest? You put it at the end. That was common sense. But it was ingenious, unquestionably the right decision, because what you get by revealing the twist early is to bring alive the whole second hour, in the same way I was talking about with the bomb under the table, but it's more complex here. Now you're watching the main character who doesn't know the twist yet, but you do, and so he has different expectations about what's going to happen, and you're just kind of watching him and waiting for him to figure it out and see if he can figure it out. But you know what? It's funny. Even now, with Vertigo, such this hugely respected film demonstrating that this kind of structure really works, I can't off the top of my head think of another movie that uses it. They all save the surprise for the end, which in some cases I suppose is a good move, as in Psycho by Hitchcock himself. But, you know, I don't know. Is there any others you can think of?
Yeah, not off the top of my head. Vertigo is a really, really strange movie. Just everything about it strikes me as being kind of bizarre the more you think about it and the more you see it. But
yeah,
there aren't a lot of movies I can think that kind of change direction like that. You're right, Psycho is another really great example. That, you know, the entire early story on Psycho is literally cut short.
Well, that's true. It does have that middle thing. I was thinking of it as a counterexample because the twist is at the end, the basic twist. But you're right, the story structure...
I mean, think about how much time Psycho spends building up her and her backstory only to suddenly drop all of
that. That is interesting. You're right. Yep. So he wasn't afraid of experimenting with unusual structures. Stephen, just name a theme. I know you can probably think of a few that I haven't talked about. What's something that's interesting?
Hitchcock loved voyeurism. a lot of his movies that like obviously Rear Window makes it very, very explicit, but I mean Hitchcock really likes to look at the way we look at things, and it makes a lot of sense if you're a film director to kind of be interested in that. Why do people watch movies? And I there's that kind of sense that he's a lot of times sort of indicting the audience. I think doubly interesting given that he's the guy who basically invented the slasher flick. Man, I really wish Hitchcock were alive today. I wonder what he'd say about Hostel 2, for instance. what does that mean that people want to go see that kind of stuff?
Yeah, out of mercy for his memory, I'm kind of glad he's not around to see it. Anyway, yeah, that's right, voyeurism, and he does indict the audience, because you think of Psycho, there's a great scene where the camera starts outside a hotel window and moves in before we start telling the story of the two people who are intimate inside that room. Rear Window, of course, you know, except for one moment in the movie, it's a key dramatic moment. The perspective of the camera is the perspective of the person peeping out his back window at all the other neighbors' rooms. So, yeah, it kind of makes us complicit in this act of peeping on other people. And yeah, that is why we go to movies, is so we can observe people without being observed. It's a voyeuristic kind of thing. Here's another one. This actually dates back to his childhood. It's kind of funny you can go back that far, but he had a fear of the police in real life, a real fear of the police. He never got a driver's license because he reasoned that, hey, if I'm not driving, I can't be pulled over by the cops. He also had a fear of eggs, but I don't think that's as relevant to his movies. But, fear of police, because what happened was he had done something wrong. I don't know what it was, but I guess it was severe enough that his father wanted to really drive home the message that he shouldn't do whatever he did. So he wrote a note out and said, hey, go down to the chief of police down at the station there and show him the note. And so he brought it down, and the police guy, the sergeant, I guess, actually, looked at it, and he said, okay. And he locked him up in a jail cell for like 10 minutes or something. Some stories say it was like overnight or whatever. Just like 10 minutes. And he let him go, and he said, this is what happens to people who do bad things. Well, I guess the point got driven home a bit too far, because ever since then he had this phobia of the police. And so that does bleed through in his movies. One of his favorite themes was of the innocent man who's wrongfully accused of something. Maybe the bad guys mistake him for being somebody else, but definitely at some point the cops will also. And so, you know, a lot of his thrillers are about a guy running away from the bad guys and the good guys. The cops are rarely the people who come to the rescue in his movies. And so, and it's a good storytelling device anyway, because, hey, if you can't just go to the cops and tell them about the bad guys, then it opens up a whole lot of more interesting possibilities of how a hero might get out from underfoot of this crime organization it has stumbled upon. So it's an interesting storytelling device, and also a very, very common theme in his movies. Here's another one. The MacGuffin is a term that comes up always when you talk about Hitchcock, and it's just a plot device. It's a way that Hitchcock understood what makes stories work on a structural kind of level. A MacGuffin basically is, it doesn't matter what it is, it's something in the story that all the other characters care about, but you don't have to care about. All you care about it is the fact that all the characters care about it. So it could be, you know, it's the typical example is the suitcase full of money. Or, you know, in more modern movies, it's the floppy disk with the information on it. It doesn't matter what it is. What matters is that, oh, the hero has it, and the bad guys want it, and he has to run away and get it to the right people. Or in a movie like Hitchcock's Notorious, it's uranium. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. Just all the characters want it. They're chasing after it, and it makes the plot happen, the part of the plot that we really care about. So the MacGuffin is a term that I don't think he coined it, but he certainly popularized it and used it repeatedly to describe the way his movies were constructed. And that's an interesting kind of thing, actually, that the plot really doesn't matter. It's really what the characters are doing that matters, and that's a kind of a subtle distinction that he understood. Here's another theme, love and death. Kind of an interesting way he treats these subjects. It goes hand in hand with his sense of humor, which is a kind of a dry, macabre sense of humor. Actually, let me talk about that first. I mean, his sense of humor, I think, really makes a lot of these work. It's subtle and British and everything. Here's a great, hilarious example of his sense of humor. He always said he wanted his gravestone after he died to read, "This is what we do to bad little boys." What a great idea for an inscription. Another oft-repeated quote of his, that he was very pleased that television was now showing murder stories because it's bringing murder back in its rightful setting in the home. You know, he's got this devilish sense of humor, and it's kind of the undercurrent. He doesn't tend to make comedies. He did make a couple, but there's always, even in his thrillers, there's this undercurrent of humor. He said at one point, you know, to me, Psycho was a big comedy. Had to be. I mean, it sure feels serious, but yeah, if you can step back and watch it the second or third time with that in mind, you can sort of see how the suspense is flavored, maybe, with this little kind of wry amusement. And we talked recently on our top 6 unfairly maligned films about how The Birds approaches its characters with that kind of mentality, too. And then there are other movies, like The Trouble with Harry, which is a comedy. It's a black comedy about a dead body that gets discovered in the woods in this kind of small, quiet New England town, and everybody has a different idea about what happened and what should be done, and they're all trying to hide at different places. And obviously this is a wonderful setup for Hitchcock's sense of humor. But sort of hand-in-hand in that is this equation between love and death, as I was saying. I think that's one of the reasons, actually, Hitchcock movies hold up so well today. We love irony today, and Hitchcock movies do have that sense of irony to them. Not quite so thick that you can't take them seriously at face value, but thick enough to create some depth to them. One of his philosophies was to film your murders like love scenes, and your love scenes like murders. What a weird idea, but it makes sense when you watch it. François Truffaut, Hitchcock being one of his early influences, there's a lot of Truffaut movies that are homages to Hitchcock, but he recognized that and concluded that, okay, in Hitchcock movies, to love and to die are the same thing. I don't know if that's really the message, or if it's just that Hitchcock found dramatic power in kind of subtly cross-linking these two things. Or, you know, maybe he just found it amusing to cross-link them. Either way, it certainly gives these scenes more weight to them. I mean, if you have a murder, and it's filmed like a murder, you have a murder. But if you film it like a love scene, that's just going to register subconsciously as something that's weird and interesting and different, and you'll be paying attention to that and thinking about it. I mean, love and death, after all, probably the two things that are most universally compelling to the human psyche. I mean, maybe food is the third thing, and you know what's weird? Count how many times food shows up in Hitchcock love scenes and murder scenes. It's kind of amusing. So you get these three things all kind of woven together in this perverse, bizarre kind of juxtaposed way, but it's all subconscious. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that only works when you recognize it. His movies are effective for that reason, but whether or not you deconstruct them that way. So, yeah, I guess the last thing to talk about thematically are his films' attitudes toward women, especially collectively. His films have this obsessive kind of hang-up with women, or his characters, his main male characters do. A lot of the heroes in his movies have issues with their mothers in one way or another, whether it's antagonistic or unnaturally close. And then, you know, the love interests. Hitchcock blondes are famous. He had a famous interest in using blondes as the heroines that would be kind of classy and refined on the outside, but could become dangerous or sensual or something once things get rough. So you can look for that too when you're watching Hitchcock movies and how he uses women and is interested in women in that way. So, I mean, that's a lot of different elements, and he made a lot of different movies, so it's remarkable that, you know, I mean, he made 54 movies. It's kind of interesting that most of them can be tied up and seen to be derived from these different themes we've talked about, and not yet feel derivative from each other. So, all right, we'll wrap it up for this week, but we'll talk about his filmography one movie at a time starting next week. This week's trivia question, short and sweet. What film holds the record for the smallest movie set ever used on a movie? Think about what it might possibly be. You might guess it if you're familiar with the movie in question, and it's not a terribly obscure movie. Check back with us at the end of the show, and we'll give you the answer.
In today's Film Buff Dictionary, we're going to talk about a cinematographic term that maybe a lot of people don't think about as being an important thing because it's always so usually fixed, and that is something called the frame rate and how it relates to these ideas of undercranking and overcranking and generally changing the speed of film. Essentially, the frame rate refers to, well, the number of frames of film that are captured every second. Or, you know, for any given period of time. If you think about it, a movie is, of course, a series of still images. And if you're capturing a bunch of still images in rapid succession, you have to pick a number per second or per minute or whatever that you're going to be capturing. Here's the thing, if you just choose whatever the heck you feel like, when it gets projected, if they don't know what you're choosing, and they just pick whatever the heck they feel like, things are going to be really strange because here's the basic idea. Let's say you capture 10 frames per second. So every second of film, there are 10 different images. Well, if I project that at 20 frames per second, so I'm going to play it through at twice the speed that you captured it, well, everyone's going to look really, really sped up and really jerky. It's going to be very strange. So we have to have some idea of what it's going to be. Now, during the early days of film, when everything was silent, movies were captured via these hand-cranked cameras. So the camera operator would actually turn a crank that would drive the film through the camera, and he had to be good at keeping a steady hand or else the frame rate would change. And in fact, oftentimes silent movies have kind of variable frame rates. There wasn't really a standard frame rate for much of silent film's history. It was somewhere between 18 to maybe 24 frames a second, somewhere around there, the mid-20s, depending on a couple of things. And then, you know, pretty quickly on, they developed, you know, mechanized cameras that could capture specific frame rates. But, you know, originally, we were cranking by hand, and you had to be good at it. But with sound came the need to really and truly standardize this. If a silent movie gets out of sync, if the projector, for instance, plays it back a little slower or a little faster than intended, not that huge a deal. Things just look a little jerky or a little slow. But if you get the sound, then you have to have it synced up, because if the sound gets out of sync even a little bit, you know, if I'm a quarter of a second wrong on my sound, so if my lips start moving a quarter second before you hear the words come out of them, things look really, really screwed up. So the industry decided at 24 frames a second. That was their standard. And so at that point in time, projection ended up becoming synchronized at 24 frames a second. But there becomes something kind of interesting that you can do if you know precisely at what frame rate your movie is going to be projected, because now you can deliberately capture at either higher or lower rate than 24 frames per second, but still have it projected back at precisely the same rate. And this gets us to the idea of undercranking and overcranking, and this idea of fast and slow motion. So if you change the number of frames recorded versus the number of frames projected, you either speed up or slow down the movie as the audience sees it. Undercranking, well, obviously it goes back to the days when people would crank it too slowly so that we would capture too few frames per second. So if we undercrank to, you know, 15 frames per second and we get on the movies, we have, say, 24 frames per second when it's being projected, then everything's going to be sped up by quite a bit, you know, more than twice as fast if you go from 10 to 24 or something. Now, on the other hand, overcranking is probably used more often, and that is going to give us slow motion, because that happens if I crank the camera really fast, right? I get a whole lot of frames per second. And if I get a whole lot of frames per second, then when it's played back at 24 frames per second, you're going to get a slow motion kind of thing. And so you can get images captured really sharply and crisply. And so overcranking still gets used quite a bit, though you still sometimes see this idea of undercranking for action sequences. A lot of war movies like to do this, for instance. It makes everything look really kind of jerky and jittery. You know what I'm probably talking about, that you've seen it in you know, the war movies where they got all this action happening and the camera's all shaky and everything has that weird jittery feel to it. That's usually undercranking. And then overcranking is going to be used for slow motion, that kind of thing. And if you want to get really crazy, it's something like, you know, bullet time, that stuff from The Matrix where the cameras swoop around something that appears to be barely moving at all. Well, that's essentially like some sort of hyper version of overcranking. You're just capturing a whole lot of frames per second, and you're actually changing where the camera is for each frame. Now, this need for the standard frame rate has another sort of important thing that is going to affect movies. If you're familiar with still photography, there are a couple of main ways that you set what's called exposure, essentially how much light's going to be captured by the image and exactly what the image is going to look like. This is probably the main thing in addition to shot composition. Setting exposure determines what the image actually looks like. And so normally you have a couple of things. You have, like we mentioned previously, the focal length of the lens. That's going to control what the image looks like, of course. And then you also have the idea of the exposure time, the amount of time that you're going to expose the film to light. And the longer that is, the more light that gets in. It lets you shoot in low light, or it lets you get some weird things. And if you have moving objects, you can't shoot with very long exposures, or else they become blurs, though sometimes that can be desirable. But here's the thing. If you are shooting a movie, you're stuck at a standard exposure value, basically, of 24 frames per second. Because if you change it, so essentially, right about a 24th of a second exposure time, though there are some things you can play around with. But essentially, if you're going to change it too much, obviously it's going to get things screwed up in projection. So one thing to keep in mind, if you're familiar with still photography, is that cinematographers don't quite have that available to them. So they have the focal length, and they'll also have something we'll talk about in the future, which is something called the aperture of the lens, how wide the lens is open. You know, the remake, kind of like the adaptation, which we've talked about before in our top six lists, is, I think, kind of a little bit, you know, looked down upon. Well, not a little bit, a lot looked down upon. And for good reason, because a lot of times remakes are kind of terrible updates of movies that never needed to be updated in the first place. For some strange reason, Hollywood is obsessed with taking great movies and turning them into mediocre films when they update them, just for no reason at all. But at the same time, there is a real sort of surprisingly high number of remakes of films that do interesting things with the original ideas. And maybe they take a mediocre film and improve it, or maybe they take a really strong film and go a different direction. And so this week, our top six list is on top six great remakes. These are just films that remake previous films, but are still really interesting and cool in their own right. Speaking of cool, my number six pick is all about how what's cool in one era is different from what's cool in another. And it's Ocean's 11 from 2001 by Steven Soderbergh, an updating of the Rat Pack film. And, you know, the Rat Pack is pretty much the epitome of cool from the 50s. And the guys from Ocean's 11, we got Clooney and Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts and Matt Damon, all these characters, are the epitome of cool in the late 90s, early 2000s. I've talked about Ocean's 11 before when we talk about heist movies, and it's a good flick, but I just really like it here because it's so interesting to see how what we think of as being cool is both different and still kind of the same in some ways. Ocean's 11 has a very sort of elegant, classic feel to it, set in Vegas still, and it really kind of, in a lot of ways, invokes that old 1950s era Vegas cool while being very modern and hip.
Yeah, it is. And, well, before I continue, I want to note that, as we sometimes do, we took different approaches to this topic. My list, I think, would be more accurately described as superior remakes. I think if I went with just great remakes that did something a little different, as you described it, I'd have at least half my picks would be quite different. And I had really had to work hard to get six superior remakes. And yeah, you're right. Hollywood, for whatever reason, you know, it picks a great movie out of the past and decides to remake that. Well, you don't need to. It was a great movie already. It's like taking Of Mice and Men and just rewrite it. We'll have the same story, just a new author. Why would you buy that? You wouldn't read it. So why would you watch a new Manchurian Candidate, even though that remake wasn't bad? We have the original. It's better. What you really should be remaking are movies that didn't work but had great potential or a great idea or something, but they don't tend to do that, so I think the number of superior remakes are pretty rare. But I found a few. One of them is Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, a movie made in the 90s. It's a kid's movie about two dogs and a cat that get lost, and it's a remake of a movie from the 60s called just The Incredible Journey, which was kind of weird. It was narrated documentary style, and it was just very definitely just children's entertainment. Homeward Bound, you know, and again, it's still very definitely directed at kids, but I think it improves on it. It's a little more complex. It has the characters talking, and they take on real personalities and have things going on in terms of character that the original did not, and that's why I like the remake better. So that's my number six pick.
Seriously? Homeward Bound?
I mean, it's actually surprising.
This is why I didn't pick Superior Remakes, because it's like...
I think it was actually a really good movie. It's not your kind of movie. It's not your kind of movie. I understand that. There's not enough lasers, but...
Yeah, boy, is it not. Okay. I'd be interested to see if this one makes your list, because I think a lot of people would make a case for it. Well, other people would not. Kind of controversial, but it's pretty rare to see a director remake his own work. But it's something Alfred Hitchcock did more than once. And I think his 1956 version of The Man Who Knew Too Much, starring Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day, is a really cool adaptation of the original. I'd be interested to see, like I said, if you have any thoughts on it versus the original film. But I have it here partially because it's a really great film, and I like the way that it incorporates music and incorporates Day's musical abilities and good, great casting. I mean, you can't go better than Hitchcock and Stewart working together. And it's also interesting to see a director updating a movie that he didn't like that much the first time around, or at the very least he thought he could do better given a second shot many years later. So it's definitely worth watching. I mean, this is, if you're interested in film, one of those rare opportunities where you get to see a director who tackles the exact same subject later on in his career.
I think if Stanley Kubrick in the 70s, say, about the 70s, had remade Fear and Desire, then we would probably have the greatest example of the quality disparity and everything. The remake would be so superior that there wouldn't be any competition for the title. But he didn't. So, moving on to my number five. Again, this isn't one I'd pick for great remakes, but it's definitely a superior remake. Faithful listeners will know I'm not the world's biggest Michael Bay fan, but I do like The Rock, and I also like a remake of his that we talked about in a recent trivia question called The Island, which is a remake of a 1979 film called The Clonus Horror, which was this low-budget, low-talent, low-any-good-at-all science fiction kind of thing, but had a good idea. And that's all the more relevant today, even, than it was at the time. Well, this story became this big summer blockbuster, The Island, and it was a huge budget, huge special effects and everything, and really flopped just terribly. But I think it's pretty fun. The first half is remarkably restrained for a Michael Bay film. I gotta give him some credit for that. Pretty low-key and character-oriented stuff. And then around the halfway mark, it suddenly becomes this ridiculously improbable action spectacular, but I thought was still entertaining even then. So not a great film, but I liked it, and it's definitely a superior remake.
Disagreed. If I can watch the original in the Mystery Science Theater 3000 version, I'm definitely taking parts over The Island, which I don't really care for at all. But okay, fine, fair enough.
I think if you get the robot commentaries from Mystery Science Theater, it's not quite the original.
Okay, can I count the robot commentary as a remake?
Okay, that's fine.
All right.
In which case, every episode of Mystery Science Theater ever.
Anyway, moving along, my number four pick is a movie that I really love, and I picked it just in part because I happened to see it the other day on cable and got sucked into it and watched the whole thing again. And it's a movie called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels from 1988, directed by Frank Oz, and is a remake of an earlier film called Bedtime Story. And the plot is similar in both films, and in the remake, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, it's all about Michael Caine and Steve Martin. It has two distinctly different con men who get into a bet over trying to con a woman out of her fortune. And it's just one of those flicks where part of it is just the performances. You have Caine and Martin just with the most ridiculously different approaches to being con men that you could imagine. You know, Michael Caine is this sophisticated, charming, elegant con man who preys upon rich widows and that kind of thing. And Martin is, of course, Steve Martin when he's at his best, sort of most bumbling, lowbrow kind of guy, willing to just take whatever he can from whomever he can. They get this whole dispute, one of them has to leave town if they lose the bet. And of course, being a great conflict, there are all sorts of neat twists and turns along the way. And just a really strong, really fun film. And I haven't actually seen the original, so I'm not sure how it compares to that one. But I have to imagine that it compares at least somewhat favorably, because this is such a fun, great little, small, quirky film.
I have seen the original. I'll tell you, again, this is the kind of movie that should be remade. It was a good idea, not a bad film, but pretty flawed, and so it was the perfect candidate to remake. One of the problems in Bedtime Story is it was miscast. You got David Niven, who's a great actor, but he's not very threatening in this. He doesn't really... A little too much polish, I think. You got Marlon Brando, who's a great actor, but he's also miscast, and I'm not really sure why on that one. But, you know, one of the things is one of the supporting characters, a woman that they, you know, at least one of them has to fall in love with a woman along the way as part of a con, and then they really, you know, that kind of story. That character in Bedtime Story is given the shaft, and she's just a very passive character, and she's much, much better in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, so... Yeah, I agree. That's a superior remake and a great remake. But it was not my number four choice. In the late 1960s, Woody Allen was a rising star. He was a stand-up comic and a playwright at that time. He was just breaking into the movies. At first, though, he didn't get to work with the autonomy he gets today and has gotten for decades. But one of the movies that came out during this time, the late 60s, was called Don't Drink the Water. And it didn't star Woody Allen, but it was based on his play, and they had another director and everything. They basically took his story and made a movie apart from him. But Jackie Gleason plays the lead, and obviously he was very good. I mean, Gleason was a genius, but the film itself is pretty uneven. You got these Allen-esque socio-political one-liners packed in right next to these terrible slapstick car chases and stuff. Allen hated the movie so much that in the 90s he decided to remake it himself as a TV movie. Sort of a strange idea, but he played the lead and got people like Edward Harriman and Dom DeLuise and Michael J. Fox to play the other roles. And this is actually really, really good. It's focused, it knows what kind of comedy it is, it delivers this non-stop parade of great funny dialogue. Not all the jokes work, but if one joke falls flat, well, you move right along to the next one. Plus, it's a little weird. I think it's always a little weird when anybody other than Woody Allen delivers Woody Allen dialogue. A lot of people have done it because he doesn't always cast himself, but inevitably what ends up happening is either you get somebody doing a Woody Allen impersonation, in which case, you know, why not just get the man himself, or you get dialogue that doesn't feel like it's really coming from the characters who deliver it. And so, for me, that's the main reason why the remake is better and funnier. The other reason is that the story takes place during the Cold War, and, you know, this family of American tourists get trapped behind the Iron Curtain and mistaken for spies, and so they're holed up in this embassy, and the commies are laying siege to it. The remake being made well after the Cold War ended, I think, it allowed Woody Allen to put some clarity on the satirical elements a little bit, as a bit of a clearer perspective than the one made during the Cold War in 1969, where it was much more muted.
Hey, nice pick. I haven't seen the original, but I have seen the 94 TV remake. Oh, great. That's a very funny, very cool movie. I didn't even know it was a remake, to tell you the truth, so nice catch there, man. Well, my number three pick is a very recent remake and a fairly famous one. One we've mentioned before on the show, but gosh, I love it so much, and that is last year's Best Picture winner, The Departed, a remake of Infernal Affairs, a Hong Kong action movie. And one of the interesting things I like about this flick is how it does one of the things a remake can do, which is it really changes the location. I mean, we move from the world of Hong Kong crime lords to the world of South Boston kind of organized crime, and this is a film that won the Adapted Screenplay Oscar for a reason. It's a wonderful, wonderful script that does a great job of really capturing sort of a lot of the spirit of a place, and the actors do a great job with the dialogue and the accents, and it's just a lot of fun. And, of course, Scorsese is, you know, it's kind of strange, you know, if I think about it, and I wanted a guy to try and capture some of the essence of the cool Hong Kong cinema, Scorsese wouldn't necessarily be your first pick, but I think that he makes a lot of sense if you really think about it as a guy who can really capture the headlong energy and just craziness of so much of the new breed of Asian cinema. So it's a movie that works really well. The original is a really well-respected film, and I think this is a good example of how to take a movie that everyone likes a whole lot and change it enough so that it doesn't just seem lame and stupid to remake it.
Yeah, and it makes a great use of the characters and the natures of the American actors that were cast in the roles. Just a great, great matching of the actors to the characters. I knew you'd pick it. I didn't need to bother, but I also agree that The Departed is a pretty brilliant film. My number three, Ocean's 11, you stole it. Fine, take it. You know, I don't see if I care. Just move on.
Okay, well, my number two is an interesting example of moving a film out of one kind of medium to another. And it's the 1995 film 12 Monkeys by Terry Gilliam, which is a remake of a short film called La Jetée, a French film that is actually a series of still images. So it's kind of a really strange, trippy film to begin with. And Gilliam takes sort of the heart of that film, which is this guy going back in time after from this ruined society to gather information, and who is just obsessed with this dream he's having where he sees this guy being killed and this beautiful woman being next to him. And Gilliam really takes all of that, captures a lot of the same kind of surreal atmosphere in the way only Gilliam can, and just working with a fantastic script and some great performances by Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt and Madeline Stowe just really expands it out and fleshes that out, has more time to build up the world of the future and the world of these various pasts that Willis visits. And it's just a wonderful, fun film and really cool. And I think we've said, you know, it's one of the best time travel movies, in my opinion. And a cool example of how you can adapt a short film into a feature. It seems sort of something that I'm actually, again, surprised don't necessarily see more of, but perhaps it's hard. A lot of shorts kind of just play around with a single concept and don't seem like they have enough juice in them for a whole feature, but here's one where it was a cool concept that was kind of interestingly done, and Gilliam did a fantastic job of remaking it entirely. So 12 Monkeys is my number two.
Interesting pick. There actually are quite a number of short films adapted into features, especially if you have a new director, an independent director especially, gets to start making a short film or something, and then later on, you know, he loves this idea enough to make that his first or second feature film when he finally gets that deal. Paul Thomas Anderson did it twice, I think, with two of his early shorts adapted into features. Anyway, my number two would be The Man Who Knew Too Much. You stole that too. Just move on. No, I'm going to claim some territory here. Can't steal all my picks. I'm going to talk about it. Yeah, it is a controversial choice. Some people do prefer the original. I prefer the remake as well, though, because I think the remake was made at a time where you can really tell it is a filmmaker at the top of his game, and when you watch the original, you can kind of tell it's a filmmaker who's still experimenting and figuring out what works and what doesn't. The remake, I think, has this wonderful richness and clarity to it. It digs deeper into the psychological elements of the story, and I think the one thing that makes this really great is the 8-minute sequence toward the end where there's no dialogue at all. The only sound you get is the music being played by this orchestra, and at the crescendo at the end of the piece, you know there's going to be a murder. So there's this race against the clock, but you're never exactly sure how much time is left, so you just keep listening to the orchestra and waiting for that moment you know is going to come. And meanwhile, what you see is something else entirely. We're tracking different parallel actions as the characters are racing against the clock and trying to communicate with each other and get to the right place on time and all that stuff. So it's a great editing job. It tracks all these different parallel actions happening simultaneously in different locations, all with this great, great soundtrack. So visionary filmmaking here, that's not something that would have been done. I mean, it is the same piece of music as in the original, but it's just not done as crisply. So I think that Hitchcock has really hit his stride by the remake, and he is able to come up with some great suspense and great psychological clarity that the remake really, really benefits from.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I was going to pick as my number one Gus Van Sant's remake of Psycho, but I know you did it, so I felt the need to just go and leave it off my list. I'm sure that's what your pick was. So,
good. My number one. Talk about that soon.
Yeah, my number one is A Fistful of Dollars from 1964 by Sergio Leone, a remake of the Akira Kurosawa film Yojimbo. And here's a really interesting example. Yojimbo is unquestionably a great film by one of the greatest directors of all time, and A Fistful of Dollars is also a great film that kind of pretty much just, without exactly permission, remade the original Yojimbo. And I'm really at a loss as to which is a better film. I mean, there's a couple of different movies. You know, I think a lot of people claim, strangely to me, that The Magnificent Seven is a better movie than Seven Samurai. It was another remake of a Kurosawa movie moved out to the West. And there is a lot of interesting parallels between the samurai movie and the Western, but here, A Fistful of Dollars, I think, is one of the best certainly of the newer Westerns, and definitely of the spaghetti Westerns. Leone was just a fantastic director, and it's such a great movie with such a wonderful performance by Clint Eastwood, who just, boy, if you want an unnamed gunslinger, you want to hire Clint Eastwood to play it. And I think, oh man, I want Clint Eastwood to do another Western right now, because I think it'd be great to see him once again reprising that kind of role. Because I think even in his films today, where we see him like in Million Dollar Baby, he's still perfect at being gruff and cool and just totally unflappable. And, you know, Fistful of Dollars definitely plays it up before he was a gigantic star, you know, working this low-budget Italian Western film. It's the start of the Man with No Name trilogy, which is going to continue with For a Few Dollars More and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And it's one of Leone's few films for a director who was so influential. He only made a handful of movies during his career. And this is just a great, great film that I think really compares well to its inspiration material, and I like the way that things are changed, but the overall theme stays the same.
Yeah, I wanted to pick this. I don't think I could pick it going by the criterion of superior remake, but I really wanted to, because I also love A Fistful of Dollars, and in some ways I even like it better than Leone's later, more epic and critically acclaimed films. But yeah, gosh, Clint Eastwood is the ultimate tough guy in this movie, and the filmmaking is just so good. Just great pacing, great music, obviously. It's world-famous music, very recognizable. Cinematography, all those things just combine to create this wonderful sense of a place. And Yojimbo is great, I think, in a kind of a different way. I love both of those with a passion. My number one... It's Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Took it again.
Wow.
Took my top three. Top three. Why did you just... I'm excited to get to my top three. Bing, bing, bing. They're all gone. I'm not going to forget this, Keller.
Ow. Well, I guess maybe there aren't as many good remakes out there as I may have thought. What are you going to do?
Hey,
huh?
Steven, let me do your recap for you. How about that, huh? Oh, number
okay.
Six, Ocean's 11. Number five, The Man Who Knew Too Much. Go ahead. Why don't you take it from number four?
My number four was Sam's first, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Don't rub it in.
My number three, The Departed. Number two, 12 Monkeys. And number one, A Fistful of Dollars, which we still can't decide if whether or not it's better than the original film.
And my number six, Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey. Number five, The Island. Number four, Don't Drink the Water. And we'll see you next week with another top six list.
Mr. Stoddard, I appreciate you taking the time to see me today. It's really great of you.
Oh, no problem. Sit down. Have a cigar.
Thank you. Oh, cigar. Great.
Now, I only have 4 minutes.
Well, I'll keep this fast.
Got to see Julia momentarily.
Well, as you know, I've got the rights to this Harry Potter 7 book, and I've looked at it, and the book's okay. We're working on the script for the film. We've got to get it out quick, and I gotta say, we're gonna make some changes to the book, but I think it's gonna be a great film. Okay.
So
here's how we start. We open up at a funeral. It's Harry Potter's funeral. He's dead. And, you know, there's lots of tears. People are crying. We saw the cast members. They're all crying. Go away to introduce everybody. And it's a real shocker to the audience because Harry's dead. How can that be? And, you know, the one character we see his friend Ron Weasley. He's looking stoic. He's trying to be strong. We push it on his face, and then we fade out to a flashback. Maybe a dissolve. I don't know. We'll work on that. But we're a flashback, and now it's the start of the year, and Harry Potter's alive, and everyone's happy. It's like the other movies, and we're going to be going through, and they do whatever the schools... I didn't read those parts too closely, but they're doing all the school stuff, the regular stuff, there's intrigue and whatnot, and we keep cutting back and forth between the funeral and these flashback sequences. And, you know, as the flashbacks progress, the story progresses, it's about Harry Potter looking to try and get these Horcrux things to kill off the bad guy, Voldemort, who... I think maybe we should just call him V. I think the kids would like it more if we just called him V. We could have action figures, but that's a different idea.
Yeah, I like that. It's catchy. It's marketing. Good on marketing.
Voldemort, it sounds a little too French or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think the kids like that.
American, that's what I want.
Exactly. So his name is V now. Anyway, back at the flashbacks to the funeral, V arrives with all the bad guys dressed in black. Instead of wearing robes or something, I imagine them maybe more wearing like a military uniform kind of thing, make them a little more dangerous.
Yeah.
Who's afraid of a guy in a bathrobe? Huh? Not me, that's who.
Sort of a Harry Potter meets Platoon kind of thing.
Right. Because people like seeing Nazis as the bad guys. So I'm thinking like, they're not Nazi uniforms, but they're like Nazi uniforms, right? So, they arrive, and then suddenly... Harry Potter reveals himself. He's actually alive this whole time. I mean, him and Ron were working together. They faked his death just so they could get V to show up, right? So V shows up, and Harry says, "Ha! I've got you in my trap." But V's got his own tricks, because as Harry Potter's followers are fighting the evil bad guys in their Nazi uniforms that aren't actually Nazi uniforms, V transforms into a gigantic snake with like three heads or something. I mean, that'd be crazy. Some it's, you know, it's like a story tall with all these heads and these claws, and just, you know, they're fighting people, and Harry's got a sword or something. He's fighting the snake, but he can't beat it, and they're fighting and fighting, and at some point in time, Ron gets killed by it. So, you know, it gives some dramatic tension. Ron's killed. The snake, you know, just impales him straight through.
I like it. So we got a Harry Potter meets Lord of the Rings thing, kind
exactly,
of.
Exactly. And, you know, you get some good action in there, and, you know, maybe the snake's going to kill Harry, but Ron stands in the way and saves his friend. Kind of like a sacrifice kind of thing. People like that. People like that. So, we got Ron dead, and everything looks like it's lost, and Harry's pinned, and V's going to eat him, bite his head right off or something. You know, I mean, nothing too gruesome, though. It's gotta stay PG, PG-13. So, anyway, all of a sudden, Rickman shows up. Snape. You know, everyone thinks that he's a bad guy, but he has the final of the Horcrux, but... Horcrux is kind of a silly word. I was thinking maybe we change it to, like, Orb of Power? Something like that. I don't know. We gotta work on that. But Horcrux? That sounds like something we shouldn't be saying in a family film. That's all I know. So Snape's got it, right? Rickman's got it. He reveals his true loyalties by destroying it! And then V's power is broken, and he turns back into a man, and he's got a sword, and Harry and him have got one of those lightsaber battles from the Star Wars movies right there, jumping around, and... Whoosh, whoosh. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're magical swords, something like that. You know, there's magic, all the fantasy. You can get away with that kind of thing. So they got the magical energy swords, and they're hitting them, and they're fighting them. And finally, Harry gets the upper hand because he's the better sword fighter, and he whonk, knocks V's sword out of the way, and V's helpless, and Harry's got a sword right up to his neck, and, you know, V's expecting to be killed, and Harry says, "I should show you the same mercy that you showed Ron, but... we're better than that." He goes, "All right, guards, take him away. Take him back to the wizard prison." He's like, "Oh, get you, Potter," or something like that.
So sort of a Harry Potter meets Scooby-Doo kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like that.
Those Scooby-Doo movies, a couple hundred million worldwide, yeah, don't underestimate them. So Harry turns around. He's got Voldemort captured. He turns around to walk off. When we see V reach into his uniform pocket, and he pulls out another wand. He's got a hidden one. He goes to cast a killing curse at Harry as he says, "Avada," but suddenly, Harry flips around, rolls out of the way, pulls out his own wand, and is even faster, and poosh, whoosh, vaporizes V. Just a giant puff of smoke. He's just vaporized, gone. And I think a good thing, you know, he's fighting on like a grassy hillside or something. We see just two black smoking footprints of where Voldemort was. I mean, that's classy. That's going to really send it that now he's dead. And now we go to another scene, and it's now Ron's funeral, and it's kind of somber and sad. It's, you know, it's like dusk or something, and they're saying some nice things about them, and Harry's standing there with his friend Hermione and Snape, you know, like the one professor whose trust he never earned, finally comes up to him. He puts his hand on Harry's shoulder, and he says, "Good work, Potter. Good work." And then, you know, everyone else, okay, finally, we know finally Rickman's a good guy, and yeah, he finally got Harry the respect that he needed. And then also Hermione reveals that she's pregnant with Ron's child, so his legacy will continue. So it's a kind of a feel-good ending there, but a little somber.
Kind of a Harry Potter meets Titanic kind of thing. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. There's romantic. Well, when in those flashbacks that I kind of glossed over, we'll play up that romantic angle a little more, you know, make it more tragic, like kind of like Titanic, exactly. Ah, man, more than a billion worldwide. You can't argue with that kind of success. So, we've got, finally then, the end credits roll, and then a little afterwards, stinger. It's Draco Malfoy back at his mansion, and his father gets killed during the battle. He's a bad guy, right? But so he's there by himself, and he's distraught, and he's just like going, "Why? Oh, no!" And then we hear a voice, and then we recognize it, just a whisper, but it's V, and he whispers, "It's not over." And then, for just one second, we focus in on Draco's eyes, and they turn snake-like, and boom! Cut to black, end. You know, we got to leave it open for the next movie, because, you know, these are making a lot of cash for us.
Yeah, yeah. So sort of a Harry Potter meets every slasher from the 80s kind of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Exactly. So we know, hey, V's dead, or is he? It'll get people talking, make him excited for the sequel.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I gotta admit, I'm pretty impressed. You know, of course, there's only so much money that can go, you know. I think it's between you and the new McGee picture, Charlie's Angels 3, The Angels Go to Hell. We're gonna think about this for a little while here.
You got a writer for that yet?
No. You in the Angels Go to Hell kind of...
I could do a treatment.
Yeah? Yeah? How would that go?
Well, you know, I'm just spitballing here, but I figure maybe the angels get on a new assignment to the desert, because it's hot, it's hell, and, oh, I know, there's a club there called Hell's Paradise or something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some sort of white slavery ring, that so they kidnap these girls and make them work there as dancers or prostitutes or whatever, and so the girls, in order to bust up the slavery ring, have to go undercover. You get them in the sexy outfits, you have it there, but you know, they're in hell because they gotta pretend to be captured, and then, you know, at the end they beat up the guys and they bust everything free.
So sort of a From Dusk Till Dawn meets From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, we could have vampires. Wow, I didn't think about that. That's I like the way you think, so
yeah, vampires are good.
So maybe they're fighting vampires. Because you get Charlie's Angels, the girls in the skimpy clothes, versus vampires. Yeah, that's two genres in one. Maybe we get Kate Beckinsale, make a little crossover with Underworld.
I'm very impressed with you. All right, well, why don't I just give you $1 billion and you can make whatever you want.
Fantastic.
It's the end of the show, which means we're all done for this week, except for the answer to our niggling little trivia question we said at the beginning. It's what film holds the record for the smallest set ever used on a movie? Steven, I know you've been thinking hard about this. What do you think the answer might be? Do you have any guess at all?
Fantastic Voyage? I mean, that was like sets the size of cells.
Oh, yes, you have a fair point there. I think I'm going to give it to you, even though it's not the answer I have. What do you have?
Well, I think they probably actually, I think the sets were probably actually a little larger in real life.
Were they?
I got a feeling.
I don't know.
I don't think they actually had the shrink technology portrayed in the film at that time.
What?
That was a more recent invention. That came out in the late 80s.
Wait a minute. You said they did that with special effects?
I think potentially there may have been some trick photography.
Oh, man.
It was mainly CGI, but I think it also built some sets as well.
Okay, well, there's another childhood illusion shattered. I'm now colder and more cynical of a person. Well, anyway, I'm going to give you the answer I had. Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat.
Oh, duh.
Takes place just after a ship has been sunk by a German U-boat and the survivors all pile into this tiny lifeboat. So pretty tiny set. I mean, it certainly looks it, too. Everybody's all crowded around and made it pretty difficult for Hitchcock to work in his trademark cameo appearance. See, Hitch was famous for having these real quick appearances in his movies and became a kind of a game with his audiences to look for him and see if they could spot him. And he's not in quite all of them, but definitely all his American films, which were from Rebecca in 1940 onwards. His first cameo appearance was in The Lodger in 1926. Anyway, his cameo in Lifeboat is considered the most ingenious, just because, you know, how do you work a bystander character into this small lifeboat out in the middle of the ocean? I'm not going to tell you how. See the movie. It's a great one. That's it for episode 44, and in fact, we will not have another episode until next month, meaning next Tuesday. But in the meantime, you can go to our website, allmovietalk.com, and you can go to rinkworks.com for a bunch of things to keep you busy until then.
And next week, we'll be talking all about, well, Alfred Hitchcock again. You might have guessed it. We'll just join a cliffhanger this time. We'll pick it up next time. And, well, we're going to need a bigger top six list, because next week's top six is all about our favorite boat movies. We've done planes and trains, strangely not automobiles, but we have boats coming up, so check back then.
Cut!
Hey, I
thought it was my turn.
Wait.
Who did it last week?
Oh, wait, hold on a second. Do the math. Carry the one.
Two weeks ago it was you, but you were subbing for me, right?
We really should. Do we have a list somewhere?
I don't think so.
Like a database?
That would make sense. Maybe we're not that organized.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and write a computer program to figure out whose turn it is, and then.
All right, but in the meantime, I want to do the cut this time, because
No.
Really,
wait, what are you talking about?
I thought that was a good cut.
Okay. You know what? Since I'm a nice guy, I'll let you do it. Go ahead. Well, go ahead.
Oh, I already. You want to do it again? All right, cut. How'd you like that one? Is that good? Or
yeah, it was fine.
All right.
But wait, shouldn't it be the last thing we say? It doesn't really work.
Well, that's usually... All right, let's just do it. All right. 3, 2, 1. Cut.